like so many other things that I've come across as a parent, thinking about interactions between my son and law enforcement, not really high on my priority list or anything that I even want to think about until it happened. And thankfully, it went really well, and I credit that to the training that the officers had received more than to anything I had done to prepare my son and how to react if police officers come over to talk to him. So I wanted to bring somebody on to revisit a topic that I had talked to Jen Lin and Lori Riaz about last year, and that's, you know, law enforcement and children with disabilities. So Stefan Byes has written articles for the International Law Enforcement Educators and Trainers Association Journal and Caliber Press regarding law enforcement interactions with individuals with autism. He's an adjunct faculty member at the Waubonsie Community College and the Suburban Law Enforcement Academy at the College of DuPage. He's also retired from law enforcement. He's a retired patrol sergeant. He has three children, three sons, two of whom are on the autism spectrum. This has given him extensive experience in both his personal and professional life and interacting with individuals with autism spectrum disorders. And today we have a pretty candid discussion about what families and organizations, specifically first responder organizations, law enforcement, can do to optimize for the best possible outcomes. Let's listen in. Welcome, everyone. Today I have with me Stefan Byes. He is the founder of Blue Line Spectrum Safety, and he's a retired sergeant, or did you retire? What did you retire as?
I retired as a patrol sergeant, yes.
So how does, we didn't talk about this before I record, but how does the ranking work? Like in the Navy, I know I retired as a Navy chief, and other military members know what a Navy chief was, you know, in terms of where they fall. So where's a patrol sergeant fall? Are you over like 20 people, 30 people, or?
Yeah, so there was three of us. We were divided by shifts. So I had our night shift. So we had three sergeants. So we're the lowest rung of the command staff. And we supervised, it would have been about 24 officers total. Wow. between the two teams. We would always have that. That was our total of our teams. We would supervise anywhere from 7 to 10 officers each night.
Wow.
So, and then we were the lowest rung of the command structure. So
how did you get into law enforcement?
Initially I got into it. It wasn't until high school that I really kind of took this path. My initial goal was I wanted to go into federal law enforcement. I wanted to go to the FBI. And everybody said, well, go into local law enforcement first, get a few years of experience and jump ship. I'm like, okay, that's my plan. And then I got into local law enforcement and loved it and never left. So 21 years. I just never did. I never left for the federal side. It was my ultimate goal, but I loved what I did and where I was at and the department that I worked for. And it was just, there was no leaving at that point. I was so committed and loved what I did and where I was working at that it was just, this is the place. So I just stayed.
Okay. And I don't know that much about law enforcement, but I got to imagine it's a pretty stressful job. So you started Blue Line Spectrum Safety while you were still in law enforcement, while you're still a patrol sergeant, right? I mean...
Correct. I did.
What brought that on?
So really the topic is, so Blue Line Spectrum Safety, my goal in this is to really train law enforcement and first responders, police, fire, our dispatchers. We're all first responders, but I really want them to understand safe and develop safe and positive strategies for interacting with those with disabilities. And that was really why I started it. The topic is very personal to me. I have two sons that were diagnosed with autism about 10 years ago. And really my motivation is, I always wondered what would happen if my two worlds collided, meaning my professional life, my personal life. Do we as first responders really understand some of those characteristics and behaviors of autism or any disability for that matter? Do we understand those characteristics and are we going to misinterpret them for something that it's not? And being on both sides of it, and I've worked at the police academy, I'm instructor at police academy, so I know what's taught there. So now that I'm understanding my son's disabilities with autism, I know those characteristics, but I also know what we teach law enforcement. So there's this now this concern of how would their characteristics and behaviors be misinterpreted as a crime? And it's really what started it. And I wanted to make sure I got that message out to as many first responders across the country as I possibly could so that their departments and those families aren't the next YouTube sensation or headline where we're just misinterpreting what the underlying cause of these behaviors were. It's really why I started. So it started very small. I did it for my own department where I worked, and then another department reached out, and then another department reached out, and then another department reached out, and 3,000 first responders later, and about 8 years of doing this, here I still am. And I mean, it's been a great opportunity and great for me to share that message and share my own experiences within my own family for those first responders to really fully understand different types of disabilities.
You know, from my perspective, like in the military, they didn't teach us to be law enforcement, right? So when you try to have military serve as law enforcement, there's going to be friction. There's going to be problems. It's not what you're trained for. By the same token, I look at it as if you're asking a police officer or a first responder to be a social worker, not what they're trained for, you know?
Oh, right.
So from my perspective, and again, I've never been in law enforcement. This is just how I, you know, from my time in the service, and, you know, and it's not the same, but if you're called to respond to something, you, in the military, we would default to worst case scenario. So we, you know, because if you're prepared for the worst case, anything else is gravy. So if you get called to a domestic disturbance or something else, you don't know what you're walking into, right? And then you see somebody maybe flapping their arms, you know, acting crazy, maybe muttering under their breath, looking like they're having some kind of episode or on some kind of drugs. I don't think you have a lot of time to make a decision, right?
No, and that's the difficult part of it, is if you don't know what you don't know. And I'll tell you, when I went to the police academy over 2 decades ago, we didn't have any training about mental health or disabilities or autism. We didn't have any of that. It was like, figure it out when you get there, when you get on the job, and you'll sort it out when you figure, you know, when it is what it is. And now we've seen like how over 2 decades, just in my career, how policing has evolved. And we are asked to go to everything. And we're asked to be social workers and parents and mechanics and everything in between, because really, when you think about it, we are the only organization that is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and people call us for everything. So we've seen how our profession has evolved into all of this. So while we didn't sign on a job to be social workers, guess what we turn out to be? We turn out to be social workers. So we have to be, in essence, a jack of all trades. And there's a topic that comes up of embedding social workers into law enforcement and having them respond to calls. And truthfully, that is a great idea, and I'm a huge advocate for it, but it's not in lieu of law enforcement.
Right.
It's working to get collaboratively with law enforcement.
Right. You know,
a lot of
the other thing I personally would like to see is I would like to see a mental health professional on each shift to download officers as they come off shift. Not every night, not everybody, but you know, if you have a tough call or something, have somebody there where it becomes part of the culture. And I'm a dude, and I recently started therapy recently. You know, I'm in my late 40s, and it took me that long to work out my own stuff. So I'm not by any means the poster child of doing it right. But I feel like, because the military is starting to do this now, the military is starting to make it okay for service members to seek out mental health, because they recognize, hey, we can keep this person in the service and get great results out of them if we address problems early and give them a safe space.
Yep. Agreed. And like, that was one of those things, again, the evolution of law enforcement is 20 years ago, if you had a rough call, it was suck it up. You got another one to go to. Now departments are becoming really more in tune. And obviously it's the rise in law enforcement and military suicide too. There's a strong military background in our family too. So we're very conscious of that as well. But you know, in my department, we had a critical incident stress management team. So if we had a major event, we would bring in outside help and outside counselors and debrief and talk about the thing and have those resources available for officers. And there's a lot of departments that are starting to do that. And you have to address that. It is a critical incident. And we talk about it. It comes out all the time. Like, the average person has 2 critical incidents in their lifetime that are very traumatic, whatever. Like, law enforcement in their career may have like 700, you know, military is in the same fashion. So, you know, we're expecting the average public to have these critical incidents and have all these resources, but we're seeing 700, you know,
right, because you're responding to everybody else's critical incident, right? Somebody has a really bad car crash, you're there. Somebody completes suicide, and you're there. You know, so you're there responding with the family, right? And those critical incidents are still critical, not just for the family, but for the responding officers.
Yes.
So those officers are now taking all of that baggage or I don't mean to be derogatory, but I mean, that's how I look at it, that baggage. And then they're responding to a parent who says, my daughter's eloped, or, you know, like what happened with my son, there's a, you know, my son looks homeless. He's got a you know, unkempt beard, unkempt hair, typically wears his shirt untucked, you know, just, he looks, I could see him being assumed to be homeless. Mm-hmm. And so at a local park around 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, you know, we had two local officers respond. Now I'm going to caveat all this by saying, I think they did beautifully, even, you know, not knowing, I didn't know what they were called for or anything, but I can imagine you don't know what the call before that was like. You know, you don't know what their home life is like. You don't know what other stress, and I'm not trying to give somebody a pass, but people are people, right? So where I'm going with all this is, without that training, I believe people fall to the level that they've been trained to. So if they didn't have this training, they're going to fall back on, like what you were saying 20 years ago, take them down to the ground.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm being extreme, Steph.
No, you're not, because that's, you know what I mean? It was, when I do my training for law enforcement, and I said, what do we use as law enforcement to gain compliance when we don't have compliance? We use pain. And I said, when that doesn't ineffective, what do? We double down the pain. So it's really easy to see how these incidents will escalate. You know, they react, law enforcement reacts. They react, law enforcement reacts. And what they're not really is this characteristics of these disabilities is that high pain threshold and all the other things that go with it. So when they're not reacting to that, then
or they're reacting the only way thing with normal person when, like, they're freaking out even more.
Right. So now we escalate it more. And that's defaulting to our training, because that was what instilled in us for 20, you know, for decades through our academy. It's only recently that we've seen to start evolve and saying, slow things down a little bit, give yourself time, give yourself distance. When you have those things, you're able to formulate a better decision and take in more information and now utilize that. You know, and it's just, but you constantly have this next generation of officers, right? You have, from in your department, you may have somebody with 37 years on, and you may have somebody with 37 days on, depending on the size of your agency. So your levels of training experience are different from officer to officer. So it's staying consistent, making sure these agencies have proper training with a vetted instructor who knows what they're talking about is critical, so that you have a department where all their officers are on the same page, same mission, and the end game is always the same. And that's why it's so critical. And this is why I started my company, so that we had a consistent training curriculum that departments could default to, and now expanding that training and be like, maybe this isn't somebody who's evasive or non-compliant or combative, and maybe it's his disability. You know, we automatically think when somebody's acting like that, that they're under the influence. And typically for 20 years, that's what we always thought. Oh, they're just under the influence. We're going. And now we're realizing there's all these other things. It's a mental health crisis. It's an intellectual disability. It's a developmental disability, or combination of all three, depending on that individual. So it's really important for us to have all that information. It was just an area that was never really covered for many, many years. And that's why it's so important. And I'm thrilled to see that agencies are starting to incorporate it. What we're seeing is agencies now, like, even if their local state doesn't offer the training, they're reaching out to independent trainers and saying, listen, we feel it's, we need this training, whether we get training through our post or the training standards board or whatever it is in that particular state. Like, we don't care. We just know this is critical, and we need that training, and we need our officers to understand that. So I'm thrilled to see the departments, so many departments are reaching out to instructors across the country that are saying, we really need training on this topic so that our officers are prepared. No chief, no department ever wants to mess this up. And that's the huge disclaimer, is like, departments don't want to mess things up. And you kind of said it, we are human. And I said earlier, we don't know what we don't know. And if you don't are familiar with those characteristics, it's really easy to misinterpret the characteristics of our kids. So,
well, and the other thing going for you is, what's your state of mind, right? If you're coming off of a really bad call, or, you know, maybe something happened, and I don't know if you roll calls, I don't know how that works, but, you know, what if your adrenaline's already off? You know, it can be hard, I would imagine, to kind of deregulate if you're, and again, I don't know, right? I just know the military aspect, when, you know, sometimes for me, it's not like I just flip a switch and I'm, you know, okay, cool. You know? So I appreciate the initial training, but is there, like, are you finding agency, and I get it, you can't speak to every agency everywhere, but, Do you find that the agencies that are reaching out to you, are they doing ongoing training for their officers? Because I'm kind of worried about a fire and forget. You know, you do it once and then you're just going to hope it sticks.
No, actually, we're seeing a repeat. So I was training a department this morning, and I was out there 2 years ago. I ran their entire department. So 189 some odd officers 2 years ago, they called me back and said, we want you to come back out. And today was my last day with their department. So I just did 8 sessions with them because they wanted a refresher. And then they reached out to me today. They're like, we have 7 new officers coming out of the academy. Can you come back out in May and just train those 7 officers and anybody that we missed in this initial run of training? So no, we're seeing departments that are repeating this thing. Some departments I've worked for where I've gone out and done the training, but we've recorded it. So now they have it. And a year down the road, they can go out and revamp and refresh in some of that training, because some of the mandates in some states are ongoing. So every 2 years, every 3 years, you have to recertify in this. But training with intellectual and developmental disabilities is not one. And I'm going to use Illinois as an example because that's where I'm from. Our statutes in Illinois indicate that officers need some initial training on intellectual and developmental disabilities, specifically in autism, and then are encouraged sometime throughout their career to get it again. It's not mandated. So that's part of the problem. So we're seeing this initiative where agencies are like, no, we want this ongoing coming in. Some of them are just doing a webinar. It's checking the box, and other departments are very engaged and want to build really an disability outreach programming. And that was part of my training as well, is understanding, like, yes, officers have to know what they're doing, but how do you have those families feel comfortable with contacting law enforcement? Yeah. I was apprehensive to contact my own agency where I lived, and I was in a very lucky position where I was able to go and train that department. I knew that they would understand and that were very familiar with my sons and our family and things like that, but not every department is like that. So I understand that apprehensive. So how do we build that relationship, build that bridge between our special needs families and our law enforcement personnel? And that's one of the critical things. And a huge part of the training is building this outreach program and having resources and events and having an open dialogue with your families to build that trust. I do parent training too, because there's really two sides of this fence, in that parents need to understand how we do our job as law enforcement, and law enforcement has to understand the characteristics of the disability. So when you do those two things together, really, you ultimately end up in the middle. And now we can hopefully prevent some of these really unfortunate incidents that have occurred across the country. So I explained to parents, I'm like, I understand your apprehensiveness, but you have to be able to build a relationship with that agency and those departments and those officers, because they will understand your loved one's disability, whatever that disability might be. But if they don't know that the disability exists, or the behaviors and characteristics, and what are some of the calming strategies and all those things that are out there and available, the department doesn't know that and can't utilize those things. So this is where you have to build that trust. And we really want to done it in a non-crisis type situation. But I always encourage our families all the time, please come in. And I had that unique bond with them, because once they found out that I was a special needs parent myself, I was the point of contact. Well, we know he'll understand because you have the commonality with. And it was a really great way to build a bond with those families. And because they understood. And if they had questions, at that time when I was still working before I retired, I was working midnight. So I was working 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And I was getting calls at like noon from families, not realizing that I was working in the middle of that. So having that resource, that go-to person in the department, is critical. And every department has some. And I will tell you this, I've been doing this training for many, many years. When I first started, I would do classes, and very rarely would I have it. Occasionally I'd have an officer come up to me and be like, oh, I have a son, I have a daughter with a disability. But now we're seeing an increase in numbers. It's almost every single class I have an officer come up to me and be like, my son was just diagnosed, my daughter was just diagnosed, or I'm hearing your characteristics of what you're talking about, and I think that's my son. And then a year down the road, I'd be like, yeah, he was just diagnosed. So we as law enforcement and first responders are special needs parents as well. And we're missing a lot of that. And those are your points of contact for your departments and things like that. But what I tell departments to do is have special needs events, a meet and greet with your families, preferably in a setting that's low key, that's open, taking sensory needs, all those things into account, but something that's not in crisis, that's comfortable. And that's where that initial start. And I will tell you what I did at our department to kind of start this going is, we'll kind of go back a little bit. This was several years ago. I received an email from a concerned parent that lived in the town that I worked in. And in summary, what it really said is that he had his concerns if he had to call our agency for assistance with his son. His son was at that point getting older and was bigger than he was at that point. So there were instances where he would need assistance with his son. My chief asked me to respond to him. I reached out to him. And what I realized is that he coached an adaptive soccer program for kids with disabilities in the town that I worked in. He's like, oh, your programming is great. Can you come meet with our families? I'm like, absolutely. Went out and met with the families and I fell in love with the program. I called them a week later. I'm like, I'm enrolling my boys and I've been coaching with him for like 7 years. So that first year that we were coaching together, we decided we were going to have a first responder game, meaning all of our kids are paired up with a buddy to help facilitate play. So the last game of the season, we took our first responders where I worked, our officers and our firefighters, and we paired them up with our kids. So it was a chance for our families to meet our officers in a very neutral setting, a very comfortable setting for their kids. But it was also a chance for our officers and firefighters to interact with kids with a wide variety of disabilities. It was a tremendous success. We had a huge touch of truck event afterwards, and we've continued it so on and so on and so on for many years. And now, as I teach the police academy, I teach the portion of interacting with people with disabilities. And they're like, part of the curriculum was they needed to have interaction with somebody with disabilities. I'm like, well, there's no easy way to do this. I'm like, wait a minute, I do. So I bring the academy class out to every year to my soccer program. I pair them up with our kids. We've done this for years. And I still have recruits that were in that class that have come back to volunteer afterwards because they were so enjoyed that time with our kids. Such thing. It was just a great special needs event that we did. And it's just one example of how we would incorporate those families and work with those families and get to know those kids and things like that. So having those events, yeah, it was an awesome experience.
I would love to see that. I haven't seen it in my community, but I would love to see it nationally. I'd love to see more locations doing that. You know, there's another thing that I've seen around here. I think it's put on by Pathfinders for Autism, which is a national organization, but they'll do traffic stops. Yes. And yeah, I get that. I understand why, and I think it's valid, but I like what you're saying because now you're getting them to see the individuals as human beings first. You know, right. Like it or not, in my mind, if you're simulating a traffic stop, the police officer is still in work mode. Right? So, you know, this is still a person who did something. Maybe it's role play, but it's still role playing as somebody who did something, who broke a law.
Right.
Where you're, and again, maybe I'm just being overly critical, but when you're meeting somebody, you're in plain clothes, or not plain, but regular civilian clothes, and you're out with a family, with individuals that have disabilities, and you're just having fun, it changes, in my mind, it changes the lens that you're seeing this person through. And now you're seeing them as a human being first, who happens to have a disability, instead of as a person who broke the law. And now you have to think, you know, now you have to focus on the disability. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to say this, but I'm going to try. I don't want people to interact with my son focusing on the fact that he has a disability. Instead, I would like our communities to get to a place where, you know, we see everybody as a human being who has value. And, oh, they happen to have a disability, or, oh, they happen to be a person of color, but they're, at the end of the day, they're a person. Does that make sense, Stefan? I mean,
it does.
And I'm not trying to be overly critical. It's just...
No, 100%, because it's why I tell our officers, I'm like, when we had this event, especially, let's go back to that, our soccer game, it's really a chance for our officers to interact with those kids in a neutral setting. So they're just seeing them as kids. And it's a given chance for our families and our kids to see the officers as just somebody who's helping out for the day. Yeah. And it changes that dynamics. And I said, look past. I said, ultimately, when it's said and done, we have tons of kids with tons of unique characteristics and different abilities. But ultimately, they're still just kids and they go out and have a good time. And really, at that event, nobody focuses on disability. Yep. They just focus on having a good time. Now, usually with the academy class, I'll have a class with them, and I'll run them through some strategies. And I give them homework. I said, okay. I said, we learned about this. Now, the player that you're paired up with, pick out some of those traits and see what you can see and how you work through things. Or here's your strategies for this player, or this player, or this player. Because we have our hiccups there, don't get me wrong. But typically, they're like, yeah, he was like incredibly athletic and he did this. And we talked my ear off about this. And he wanted to talk about cars or planes, whatever that restricted interest was. And I'm like, did you really even notice that he was use the wheelchair, or use the walker, or use all this thing. They're like, no, we really didn't. You know, so it's like, it's exactly what you're, it's almost to the point to what you're saying, Eric, is like, we want to look past that. And it's, we talk about people first language, but it's really people first interactions. It's critical.
And like you had said, there's two sides of this coin, right? So parents have to see law enforcement, first responders as people too. Like, I will admit, I get a cop behind me, even if without their lights on, and my heart speeds up a little bit. Even if I'm not doing anything wrong, it still speeds up a little bit, right? When the two officers brought my son home, my heart went up, right? And you know, because so I think I'm probably as guilty as the next person that I don't immediately go, oh, police, yay. I mean, you know, so I think there's that other side of it for parents too, where we need to be able to see the officers as human beings and accept the fact that, yes, there are some bad apples out there, and they're the ones that are perpetrating these crimes that we're seeing on my words, not yours, because they may not have been found guilty yet, but they're doing these what I feel to be very horrible things. But that's not the majority of law enforcement. It's a minority who is getting a lot of press. And that press is coloring our perception of everybody else.
It is. And I kind of explain that. It's like, you know, most people's interaction with law enforcement is only an enforcement capacity, or you're having the worst day of your life. Nobody calls law enforcement. It's like, you know what? I'm having a great day. I just wanted to call and give you an update. That just doesn't happen. So we can have those interactions outside of those two aspects of what we do as law enforcement. That's great, because then you're kind of, to your point, is we are being seen as human beings. So these special events and different things and community outreach is the way to be able to do that, not just enforcement and not just in when you're in a crisis and need that assistance. I agree with you. And to go to your point too, it is a handful of horrible officers that are committing some of these horrible events, 100%. And just like anybody else, nobody else wants to be stereotyped in that group, law enforcement group. Nobody hates a bad cop worse than cops, but it's worse than a good cop. And we don't want to be shedding that light. But truthfully, that is the narrative. And it's, you know, and without getting statistics, like, there's a lot, I think, I forgot what the actual numbers are, but such a minor number of events or interactions with law enforcement across the country actually end up in a use of force situation, a deadly force use situation. It's even smaller than that. It's microscopic how much it is, but you would think that this happens on a regular basis. And truthfully, it's actually very rare with some of these events that are occurring. And I think it's important for people to understand it. And but bad news sells.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, bad news does sell. And that's part of the unfortunate thing. And
well, and the other thing, the problem that I think the bigger problem is when it does happen, it's not a one-on-one situation.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's almost, you know, the most recent one I can think of is there was 5-on-1, or even if one person was being physical, the other four didn't step in to do anything. And I might have my numbers off, but, and there's psychology about why that stuff happens and stuff. And I get all that. Like, I understand the psychology of how that can happen, but it makes it really hard as a parent. And I'm a cis white guy, right? It makes it really hard for me to be okay with reaching out to law enforcement and saying, I need help. Oh. And so then I think about people of color. I think about people whom English may not be the first language. You know, especially if they may or may not be here legally, you know, and it just creates all this other stress. But there's still parents like you and I are.
Right. And that was the community that I served, that I worked in for 2 decades. We had a very large Latino population. So there was a language barrier, there was a cultural barrier. And we know statistically wise that our children are considered minorities are underdiagnosed, right? The same resources are not available to them. We know that. And there's always this, now there's this cultural barrier where, you know, in those Latin American countries, law enforcement is just, they are not trusted, right? They are in essence, they're criminals. They will never reach out. So it translates in the same thing to here in the United States, that they're seen as corrupt. And it's like, it's a hurdle, but it's a hurdle that we have to clear. So like, we talk about some of the resources that our department offers, specifically our special needs families. We did everything in Spanish as well. So it was in English and Spanish. We really wanted to cater to those underserved populations. And that was the big underserved population that we had in my community that I worked in. So we did everything, and everything was in English, everything was in Spanish. So
if you're in a predominantly Korean community, it could be done Korean or Hmong or any of these other languages, right?
Yes. And really, you want to adjust the way you're doing things based off of the demographics of the community that you serve. It's pretty simple when you do that. You don't want to isolate anybody and leave them out. So we would, and if we had a language for a special needs family that was in our town that didn't understand those resources, we would find a way to make sure those resources were available to that family in whatever language was comfortable to them. We had a special needs family that their loved one only spoke Korean. It's not that easy to find a Korean translator in my department. Yeah. We didn't have one, but we found a way to make sure that we had those resources available for that family. So we met their needs, but it's understanding the demographics of your of the community that you're serving. So it is critical. And the outreach has to be, you have to do more of an outreach and more of an effort with those families, because there's this inherent distrust because of whether stereotypes or things that are happening, past experiences, and overcoming that. But there are clearly ways to do that. And it filters right back into our special needs families, that there is this apprehensiveness to contact law enforcement for the fear that their loved one's disability is going to be misinterpreted as a crime. So that outreach has to be even stronger and has to be more persistent. And has to be greater because you're now overcoming these additional barriers, whether it's race, language, culture, fear, all those past experiences, all those. So we as law enforcement has to make that extra effort and take those extra steps. We really have to be the one to extend that olive branch farther than anybody else. And that's the way it should be done with departments.
And you can't have a bad day. I mean, because one old crap strikes out a million edibles. So you really, to me, it adds pressure because you really can't afford to have a bad day. You know, it's almost like people are just waiting for you to make a mistake to say, see, we told you.
So you're absolutely right that it's one negative experience can destroy years worth of positives. But it's really, if you're having that outreach and you have a positive impact with your community, it's like you're filling a bank account, right? If you're consistently making deposits, when you have that bad experience, when you make that withdrawal, you're not going to be overdrawn, right? Because you've already built that, in essence, collateral with your community. And that's where we consistently have to take advantage of those and, in essence, take control of our own narrative as law enforcement. We should be publicizing the good things that we're doing. If we were relying on somebody else to do it as law enforcement, it's never going to get done, right? So this is where we encourage departments to take control of your brand. Right, and take advantage of that. We have control over social media, our social media, that you can put things out to your communities. And that's, again, building that collateral within your department and within your community so that when you have that bad incident, and you will, right? It may not even be bad, but it may be interpreted as bad. Your community's like, that was one isolated incident. We have a great department. We have a great relationship with our department and the community. And we get this was isolated and the damage control is minimal. And I don't want to say damage control, but in essence, that's what it is.
Yeah. And hopefully there might even be enough of a relationship where you, the community and the, the law enforcement leadership can have a communication, can doesn't have to be public. I'm not saying drag you guys across the coals, but the civilian leadership and the law enforcement leadership can get together and say, okay, what are we doing about this? Was this an isolated incident? Do we need to do training? In the military, it was always do a debrief. What happened? Because usually when there's a big oh crap, it's a series of smaller oh craps that just built up. It's very rarely just a spontaneous boom, right? It's usually little things getting ignored, and then it becomes a bigger thing.
Right. And it's usually what it is. When you dissect these incidents, you can see that there was a trend or a pattern or areas that you were lacking in that led to this incident. But again, controlling your narrative and controlling what you're doing in your departments. And I tell our special needs parents, like, if you feel that your department is not serving you, you go to that department and be like, I have a loved one with a disability. What kind of training are you getting? What's your programming? Have you had an outreach program? Can I bring my kids here? No department is going to say, absolutely not, we're not doing it. That's not the case. But this is where parents have to be advocates as well and take on an active role. As a department, we may be serving 40,000 people. We don't know everybody that has a disability in our community. But those community members don't know exactly where to find us every single day. So I tell parents, be your own kid's best advocate. listen, as special needs parents, we know when it comes to the school district, we are our advocate. When it comes to our financial planning and things with our kids, we are their advocates. But when it comes down to law enforcement or that aspect of it, we're like, we don't want to touch that one. Well, it's going in with that same passion that you would in those other areas, the same way you would with law enforcement. I did. I mean, I had a unique perspective, and then I was already doing this. I was in the field, but I went to where I live, my department. They didn't reach out to me. I reached out to them and I said, listen, I do this training. This is what I do. I live in town. These are my kids. And I want to make sure that you understand. They're like, absolutely, please come in. And I did. So taking that proactive role is critical. So if your department's not having an outreach program or having, you know, are accessible for their officers, then you take an initiative as a parent and do that as well. And it's part of our program. And we talked about that, our adaptive soccer program. Like, on the flip side, it's like I do it for law enforcement, but on the flip side, our programs for top soccer, which is done through USU Soccer, like I'll be down in a symposium in 2 weeks down in St. Louis, and I'm presenting on this exact topic, but I'm doing it for the soccer coaches end of it, like how to have this outreach, reach out to your departments, tell them we want to include you in this. But again, it's both sides of the fence, and it has to be proactive on both sides.
And I would caution parents from finger pointing or be constructive, right? Like,
yes.
And that is for any interaction, be it IEP teams, be it teachers, be it, I don't care who you're talking to, you will get better results. You know, what do they say? You know, honey, you attract more
flies with honey than you do with vinegar. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, you, and think about your own reaction when somebody comes at you and starts pointing their finger at you figuratively or for real and saying you didn't do something. What is your first reaction? Are you like, oh, well, let me listen to this person with a nice, calm manner right. And see how I can respond in a nice, calm manner? Are you going to get defensive, right?
Right.
But if you, and I'm not saying do a compliment sandwich either, where you say something nice, say something negative, say something nice. I mean, but maybe reach out when things are going well and say, thank you for this. Some people start associating you with positives. So when you do have something to say that needs to be corrected, or you know, you're finding fault with something, you don't get lumped in with everybody else that's always just piling on top of these guys, right?
And that's where that trust comes from. If your community in your apartment has trust built, that you've already started to do that, you've had that open dialogue and things like that, and you have trust, you're a lot more receptive to somebody that you have a relationship with or feel comfortable with or have trust built with for them to come and say, like, you guys could have really done better on this situation, or we really think this is an area that is lacking in whatever it is. And, you know, can we work together collaboratively to build somebody, to bring somebody in here? And it, you know, kind of going hand in hand with that, part of some of the departments I've gone out and trained, there's a not-for-profit that I paired up with a little bit, and they're very passionate about training agencies. And that not-for-profit went to their agency where they're in and said, we want this training, and we have a person that is willing to do it. And the department's like, absolutely. And now they have this great relationship with this not-for-profit. And they have a huge special needs event every April for Autism Awareness Month. And they're planning theirs within the next couple of weeks. But it was that not-for-profit that went to that agency and said, this is what we want to do. How can we collaboratively work together? Like going in defensively. And there's so many special needs parents advocacy groups out there that are a great resource that departments aren't utilizing. And I tell departments, I'm like, you're looking to build this outreach program, look at the resources in your backyard. You know, we had a special ed co-op that would serve our entire county that I worked with, and that was part of I did our parent group. But we also had a special rec housed in our community where I worked. And they had, you know, adaptive sports, whether it was basketball, we had wheelchair basketball, and there's all things we participated in as an agency that was great. But we had those things right in our backyard that you could utilize and build that relationship with. So utilizing those advocacy groups, if you are a parent and part of an advocacy group, reach out to that department that you live in or that you serve and say, how can we collaboratively work together? And this is how those relationships are built.
So, and I appreciate all that. And you know, so as we wind it down, can you be a little clearer on how to reach out to the department, right? Do you go to the department website? Is there, where do you find who to reach out to? I mean, let's just be real for parents, right? Like it's one thing to hear this, but as a parent, where do you even start?
Great question. So the easiest way to do it is go to the top, go to the chief or the upper command staff. Most departments have at least their upper command staff's web email address is available.
Okay.
So you can go to their website, look and see who the chief is. And 9 times out of 10, there is a contact the chief email address that you can click on and send an email to. Almost every department has some form of feedback forum, whether it's on their website, through their dispatch center, whatever it is, a feedback forum that you can reach out to as well. But if you're familiar with that department, I will tell you your best advocate and your best partner will be a first responder that has a special needs child, because now there's a commonality. Another great way to reach out through a department is if your child is in a school and they have a school resource officer, okay. They're your best contact because there's a relationship between the schools, that officer, and those families. Your school resource officers are great points of contact as well. Many departments have a crime prevention or a community outreach unit that all they really do is community events. They work with seniors, disabilities, different programming. And a lot of times, if you just go on the social media of the department, you can easily determine who these officers are and reach out to them directly. So they're great places for families to start. And truthfully, if you're that desperate, walk into the police department during business hours and be like, this is who I am. I'd like to speak to somebody about how we can collaboratively work together. Somebody will come down and heed that warning from you as departments. But it's being persistent. It's being persistent and being that best advocate. Every department will take on that additional help. Again, kind of saying it, we know what we don't know, right? And we are, as parents, especially these parents, we are our best advocates, and we're that department's best resource in how to build that layer of trust, because departments sometimes just don't know how do we do that. You know, how do we start this path, or how do we build those bridges? But as parents, we can be that catalyst as well. So again, kind of going on both sides of the fence, I've seen it on both sides, and I have done it with my own agencies where I lived in and work with them and things like that. So being those special needs parent advocate groups are a great way to start, because now you're going as a group collaboratively. This is what we provide. How can we work together with you? We want to be a resource for your department. We want to reassure. And this goes police and fire. It's not just law enforcement. The fire departments are well another one. And right, I talk about it, my training, it's first responders. So I do police, fire, dispatchers. You got to remember, our dispatchers are the first line of interaction with law enforcement. When you call and that person answers the phone, it is not a police officer. It is your dispatcher.
Right.
So training and understanding for your dispatchers is just as critical, because they are that first line, a first layer of communication with our families. So making sure you include them in this process as well, because they are a critical part of what we do. And without them, our first responders don't get to where they're going to go. So people automatically leave out our dispatchers, but they're critical. I say that because my wife was a dispatcher, and that's where we met. So I have to do the plug for the dispatcher as well, but they're a huge advocate, a huge resource for our departments, and we don't function without them. So make sure you include that dispatch center as well. It's very important.
And if there was anything you would tell people not to do, like, you know, above all else, you know, what would you tell them not to do?
Really, don't be confrontational, right? Ultimately, like, if you're confrontational, the officers are just going to shut down, right? Anything you say is not going to make any headway. It's just not. And the same thing goes for the officers as well, though, too. But for our families, like, even if you're upset, have a cooler head and address the concern later. And this is one of the things that I know this is going to get people get really upset about this, but compliance. When the officer asks you to do something, do it. Most states, it is the law. You have to comply. Doesn't mean you can't have your day in court. Doesn't mean you can't argue it down the road. But an immediate compliance is critical. And this is what we teach our kids when those compliant in those situations as well. We want to teach our kids compliance. And this is where the parent training comes in as well, is we want them to say, this is what we do as law enforcement. Here is the expectation. Like, the expectation is you have to comply with the officer's orders. You have to. If you don't, in essence, that's a crime, and now you're building on it. Not saying you can't go back down the road and file a complaint or have your day in court and things like that. But in the immediate, at that moment, compliance is critical. And this is what I tell parents, our special needs parents, like, we really want to teach our kids that when the officer tells them to do something, they have to do it. Compliance is critical. We don't, and the law enforcement side is, we need that compliance. And when the compliance is there, it's a reduction in use of force in general on all the other strategies that we have. If the compliance is there, there's no need for any of that. That's what I tell our parents.
What makes it challenging, Stefan, is, we teach, you know, a lot of our kids don't pick up nuance, right? So yes, we want you to be compliant But law enforcement, we don't want you to be compliant with Mr. and Mrs. Smith if they're trying to get you to do something.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's, yeah.
It gets hard.
Right. And I kind of with that paratraining goal, I talk about layers of trust and building those parents. And where do our first responders fit into that layer of trust? And it's kind of like this, it's almost like a graph of saying, well, here's where your first responders fit in. And here's where a stranger fits in. So it's kind of teaching those boundaries as well. And having our kids like, see if it's different with my kids because they grew up with me in uniform. It's nothing to like, be around a police officer was no big deal for them. Their uncle is a police officer. I was a police officer. We were a law enforcement family. But for a lot of kids, they've never had an experience with somebody in uniform. So my kids were very comfortable, but other kids were not. But understanding that when we let our kids know that our first responders are number one, there to help. And number two, they're still in a position of authority. And we know that they are there to help. And we want them to know that they can go to those first responders or police and fire for assistance when it's needed. If they're confused, if they're scared, like knowing these are safe people to go to, understand that. Another big thing I tell parents is have a way for first responders to identify that your loved one has a disability, whether it's an autism information card, saying that they can present, saying this is my name, here's my triggers, here's my emergency contact information. One of the resources that we offered our families in my community where I worked, we had window clings. So the families could put them on their cars and their houses. So when we arrived as first responders, we knew we were interacting with someone with a disability. Once we had that information, we can change our strategies and tactics and things like that, knowing what we're interacting with. Yeah. I know it's controversial and people are pro and con against special needs registries, but I will tell you on the law enforcement side, they are essential tool. In essence, what a special needs registry is that you are registering your loved one with that department ahead of time. So when you call 911, that address and phone number pops up, it will send an alert to the dispatchers, which will relay to the officers that there is someone with a disability that lives in that residence. That's great. So now the officers are now knowing, okay, I'm dealing with somebody with a disability. That's great. That's the first level of it. The second part is having that information available to the officers on a call for service. So I will tell you, and let's use wandering elopement for a second. The vast majority of time, we located people that hadn't even reported missing. We had more fines than we ever had reporting looking for a missing. But if you have somebody who's nonverbal, can't communicate, how are we ever identifying this individual if they can't? So this is where those special needs registries and these identifiers come in are critical. So a couple instances we had in my community where we located, I can think of three off the top of my head, we located an individual who were nonverbal, couldn't identify themselves, and they had wandered off. And we had no call that they were missing. So now we're in this struggle of how do we identify them, reunite them with their families. And our special needs registry, we were able to access it on a call for service on an app on our phones. We were able to identify the individual, contact the loved one, and reunite them within 10 minutes, where it could have taken us hours prior to that. And this is the use of technology and things. So this is why the special needs registries are so important. In larger jurisdictions, it's harder. I was a town of 40,000 people. We had about 70 officers. So it was much more manageable for us. But you look at a large agency, a large metropolitan agency, it might be a little more difficult. But vast majority of departments in this country are under 20 officers. So most of them are small officers where this is very effective. So those special needs registries are critical for families. And I know some parents are like, we're going to be labeled or alert, things like that. And that is not the case. I will tell you, in Illinois, our law is called premise alert, and it's mandated that departments have a special needs registry and we do our due diligence to publicize it to our special needs community. So it is in place here in Illinois. I don't know what other states it is, but departments have to have one. So every department, at least in my state, in Illinois, has some form of it, whether it's done through their dispatch center and or their department. And it's a great way to do it. And I pushed our premise alert program really, really hard with our families.
There's an international organization called Lifeline that I've heard about too, that other agencies are adopting. I will admit that I'm not a huge fan of registries. I mean, hearing your point of view, Stefan, I can see why law enforcement find it valuable. I'm just paranoid, you know, and I say that, but by the same token, I after my son was brought home, I did call dispatch and I did make sure they knew that, you know, he was at my address, and because I could worry about something that might happen in the future. Or I could deal with what is really happening.
Right.
You know, and prior to my son being brought home, I was worrying about what would happen in the future. And thankfully, you know, it was all resolved, you know, as well as could be. But, you know, in hindsight, if he'd been in the registry, I don't know. I mean, my point being, I could see both sides. I'm still a little bit of a hesitant about registries in general because of my concern that they can get taken, you know, that they can be blown out of proportion or taken out of context or just abused. But so can a lot of things, you know. I mean, so I get it. I mean, but this has been awesome, Stephanie, and I appreciate you giving concrete examples to parents for what they can do with regards to, you know, reaching out to school resource officers, the chief email on the website. You know, that's how I found my chief, actually going to the Frederick City Police Department. They had a complaint line, like you were saying. They actually had a place where you could log complaints, and then they had his email. So you're spot on there. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you? Is there anything that you want to make sure we touch on before we get going?
No, I think we really covered it. But I will tell you this as a parent. I would reach out to your local departments and be like, and ask them, like, I have a loved one with a disability. What kind of training are you providing to your officers? I would ask them, because if your department says we don't have any of it, then it's time as the advocate parent to step in and be like, well, listen, we really encourage you, and we'll work with you to find somebody who can train, or we'll work with a nonprofit, or we'll work with a special needs organization to help find somebody. But we really feel like it's critical that you have this kind of training. Every department is getting cultural awareness. Every department is getting implicit bias. Everybody's getting de-escalation. But how many of your departments are really getting training on specifically on how to interact with someone with disabilities? It is still very, very, when it's not 100%. I will tell you that right now. What the percentage would be, I don't know. But I will tell you, it's probably maybe around 60%. That's a lot of departments that aren't getting any training at all, or officers that have had a little bit of training, an hour training in the academy, and never had it again. So that's an area that, as parents, we can start to change. And awesome. That is a critical thing. So as from the parent perspective, is be an advocate for your kids at all levels. With your first responders, is no different. It's no awesome. Different.
Well, this has been great, Stephan. Thank you. And if people want to find you, your website is Blue Line Spectrum Safety, right? If they go to there, is that still an active website? You're still actively training?
Yeah, I am actively training. I was at a department this morning. Got another group of officers tomorrow. So I'm keeping busy with that. But yes, you can go to my website and you can post questions.
Do they have an email that they can reach you there?
There is an email on there. You can leave a comment on the website itself, or my email address is on there. You can feel free to reach out that way, and I will. You know, I'm usually about a 24-hour response. I'm still working full time on top of doing this as well, but I have a busy schedule. But I will always get back to families. And again, resources are available. Many departments have resources available on their websites. You just go and see and check and see what they have. It's a great way. And reaching out to your families. But yes, that's the easiest way to reach me.
And will you, if a parent group wants you to come out and speak to a larger parent group, would you be able to be it Zoom or whatever, because you are in Illinois, but would you do that if they want, like I'm thinking like, what are those called? When you're in school and you have those PTAs or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You know, would you give talks to them, those kind of organizations?
I do. Actually, I do quite a bit of fair parent groups. Like I said, I worked with our special ed co-op in the county that I worked in. They had a parent group. I went in at least once a year and met with them. But I was also president of my special needs parent group in my own kid's school district. So it was an officer. So yes, absolutely. I've done plenty of parent groups. I will continue to do parent groups. That presentation is more geared on like overall safety, but there is a huge law enforcement base, but it's safety in the home, safety in thing. Here's what you can do. If you have an active eloper, wanderer, here's some things that take place, things like that. So yes, I will absolutely do parent groups as well.
Awesome. Thank you again, Stephan. This has been awesome.
You're very welcome. I really appreciate the time and being on with you today. Again, I followed your podcast a long time. And I know you talk about investment for our kids. Well, and again, this is an investment in their futures as well. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
I enjoyed that conversation. It got me thinking. Prior to the incident with my son, I didn't know where to go to reach out. I know we had heard over and over again, reach out. So I liked that, you know, Stephan said to go to the website for your local police department or sheriff's office. The chief probably has an email address in there somewhere to contact him. And like my state had a feedback form. You can also reach out to your school resource officer and or see if there's a community outreach department. And as a last resource, Stefan said during work hours, during working hours, go to the local police department and say you're looking for help and you want to introduce your child to the organization and find out. I wouldn't bring your child with you, but I would find out what you need to do to get the child and the law enforcement officers familiar with each other. The other thing to talk about is it's not all on parents. It's also on law enforcement, but law enforcement is like anybody else. Nobody wants to be put on defensive. So if you're being critical or if you have things that you want to point out, do so in a constructive way. Try not to point fingers or use terms like always or never. Just all the things that you would do to have a very successful interaction with anybody else, a coworker, a boss, an employee. Try to have that same approach when you're working with law enforcement. And please remember, both law enforcement and parents alike, we're all human. Let's try to treat each other as human beings first. And I think outcomes can only get better from there. Thanks for listening.